Can I tell you a good Chris Lee story?
Yes, of course.
I'd always say, Chris, tell me about the war. And he'd look at me and go, John, you know I'm not allowed to discuss it. So I'd say to his wife, get him to tell me about the war. And she'd say, John. And, you know, always, I'd always tease him. So one day we're at lunch, and, you know, he even when he was ill, he's so elegant, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I said, Chris, tell me about the war. And he thought about it. It was just us in this booth. And he leaned forward and he said, can you keep a secret?
I'm Elijah Wood.
And I'm Daniel Noah.
We grew up on John Landis's films, Animal House, Coming to America, An American Werewolf in London, and so many more. He made stuff that was highly significant in both of our childhoods, and he is truly one of our heroes.
We were a little bit nervous going into this because John is a big personality and he does not suffer fools, but he warmly invited us into his home.
We had an incredible conversation about genre, his perspective on movies, and the choices he made that led him to create such enduring art.
And remember, if you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so you never miss an episode.
This is Visitations
with Elijah Wood
and Daniel Noah.
And now, John Landis.
Funny when you go to the homes of your idols and like I was in my head, I always imagined like it's a mansion on a hill, like a, you know, with like a gate and servants and like, no, these are regular people just, living regular lives.
Yeah, in a regular home.
In a regular home. Yeah, it's a beautiful home.
It is. And they have a nice mailbox.
All right, come in.
All right, so here's what you want to do.
I already said no.
What
good,
do I want
so
to do?
You want to walk? You want to record as you walk into the house?
Yeah.
Yeah, I already said no. Oh, didn't she tell you?
Oh, no, she didn't. She hasn't had a chance.
Okay.
All I was going to say was I just want to use your restroom while they're miking you.
No. Okay. Do you need this much equipment? So this is Ray Harryhausen's last sculpture. And I think he was helped by this guy, but Ray was a good friend of mine. Look how cool this is, because he's animating the Cyclops and the Dragon from Seventh Voyage, but there's From It Came from Beneath the Sea and Mighty Joe Young.
Wow.
And isn't that cool?
And so he sculpted this.
Yeah.
When did you first meet him?
As I know, I met him in the early 70s.
What were the circumstances?
At Forry Ackerman's house, you know.
Okay.
Wow.
But I became friendly with them. I mean, really friendly with them. I'll show you.
Okay.
This picture, when I was 11, I think 11 years old, I wrote a fan letter to Ray Harryhausen. Oh my God. And I sent it, came care of Famous Monsters of Filmland in New York, of course, although I didn't know Forry lived in Hollywood or Horrorwood, California. Anyway, it was sent, you know, all the mail was then sent to Forry in L.A. Forry forwarded it to Ray in London. And I got, about 4 months later, this in the mail.
Wow.
It's Ray animating the dragon from Seventh Voyage on the miniature set. And it says, John Landis, best wishes for your success, wow. Ray Harryhausen.
Oh, my God.
And I cannot tell you how thrilled I was.
Oh, I can imagine.
Oh, man.
What did that do? Were you already dreaming of making films?
Oh, yeah. Since I was eight.
To touch that.
Well, since then, for many years, when we had our other house, we had a really nice guest house, and Ray and Diana would always stay there. So, like, he kept signing it over the years.
Wow.
So, during this, there'll be phones ringing and dogs barking and whatever else happens.
No, that's fine.
How do you feel about the state of genre today?
There are some people say that we're experiencing a little bit of a golden era or a renaissance.
Here's the thing. Genres having, when they say a renaissance, it's not like the 60s when there were drive-ins where there were many more genre movies right. being made.
Sure.
One of the reasons for that is this is started. You can put this on Lucas and Spielberg because Star Wars and Jaws, both those movies are solid B pictures. Both were made with A budgets. Mm-hmm. So what's happened now, we have comic book movies mm-hmm. being made with big stars and costing hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So when the studios are only making big budget exploitation pictures, that means smaller budget exploitation pictures are now competing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There used to be A and B pictures. And the biggest change in the movie industry is B pictures are now A product.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's really new. And in terms of movies, critics have never respected comedies and horror films. Yes. And there are many reasons for that. The main reason to me is that they're harder to do for most people, which I really don't understand because...
It's natural for you.
Also, I think if you can direct a Western, then you can direct... a musical. I mean, it's put the camera there, you guys do this. The director's job doesn't change. Not only that, but budgets don't impact directing. I mean, it's put the camera there, you 6,000 guys do this.
Right.
Or you 12 guys do this. The point is, the director's job is exactly the same. So is the cinematographers. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, and so is the editors. So the basic storytelling is not impacted by the genre, by the budget. I mean, it's whatever it is. It's a Western, it's a war movie, it's a romance, it's a musical, it's a horror film. And you can break down every genre into mini genres. Mm-hmm. How many kinds of horror films are there?
Right.
And that Boris Karloff and Christopher Lee and Vincent Price, those three guys especially, but they hated the term horror film.
It's interesting.
I agree with them. You know why? Because it's very easy to horrify someone. Mm. Look, here's a shredded puppy.
Right.
You're horrified.
Yeah. Well, Friedkin rejects the term horror for Exorcist, right? He refuses to...
I understand that. I think it's too late. But still, I understand it because... Yeah. That's like me getting... I always get aggravated when they call werewolf a comedy.
Yeah.
But it is funny.
It's very funny.
I can't, But it's deliberately funny, too, which is unusual in a horror film. I think American Werewolf works, and obviously it does because people are still watching it, but I think it works mainly because what I tried to do in that mm-hmm. was, first of all, it's totally serious, mm-hmm. and it's definitely a horror film. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's meant to be funny. Yep. But I don't think it's a horror comedy or a comedy horror.
I agree.
The situation.
It's tragic.
It's a straight ahead. I mean, my wife once said to me, you put the B in subtle. Wow. And I thought, did you make that up? She did. Anyway, that was because in American Werewolf in London, the boys were introduced to them in a truckload of sheep. They go to the slaughtered lamb. I mean, they are dead from the first frame.
Yeah.
And they're doomed.
They're doomed.
Yeah.
And anyway, the reason I think it works is because what I try to do when dealing with stuff like this, and it's something John Carpenter did brilliantly in The Thing, which is treat it, it is a ridiculous situation. There are no vampires. There are no werewolves. There are no living dead. It's not true. Mm-hmm. There are no ghosts. There are no giant dinosaurs. None of these things are true. So.
Maybe ghosts. Keep going.
Maybe for you. So. what's that behind you? No. So. My point is, when you're dealing with something that is inherently ridiculous, there's an extra hurdle. Mm-hmm. All movies, all books, all works of art have suspension of disbelief. Mm-hmm. You want to not be here as, Dan and Elijah on the couch. You want to be in the movie.
Yeah.
And Some Hollywood producer once said that we're in the transportation business, which I liked because that's true. When you go to see Lord of the Rings, you're not in
you're
West
in Middle Wood. Earth.
You're
yeah.
in Middle Earth. Yeah. And if it works and you care about the characters, you're there. And that's called suspension of disbelief. Best movie ever did that for me was The Exorcist. Scared the shit out of me.
I was going to say, going to bring that up as another example of what you're saying I love so much is that idea of taking the subject matter seriously. You present it as real. Is that what you're saying?
Because
that's what Friedkin did.
You not only present it as real, the people in the movie are intelligent. No, it's not real. Therefore, how do you deal with something that does not exist when it's in front of you? Mm. And that's the hurdle you got to get over.
Yeah.
So when, it's the classic cliche things where it's like, don't go in that door, when you're watching the teenagers. They're always, especially in slasher movies.
Of course.
But people, they're always like, why don't you call the police? Yeah. Just logic stuff.
Yeah.
So in Werewolf, my intention was to play it not only as totally real, but have them respond as a fairly educated person would. It's not true. David just assumes he's losing his mind.
Yes.
I think something that you're, in my opinion, you're not given enough credit for is bringing realism to genre. And that's inclusive
of
Exorcist, comedy.
The Exorcist. Well,
but we were talking about how it's Friedkin always gets it, but it was really both of you. You were both doing
it. Well, his movie's way before mine. His was in the 70s.
I know. But the thrill for me as a kid of seeing these characters, the Blues Brothers, that I knew from television in a very silly, very kind of inauthentic context, seeing them not only given the Hollywood treatment, but in a way that felt hyper-realistic, in my hometown, no less, Chicago, was beyond description.
I imagine it's a different movie if you're from Chicago.
I think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, the nuances of it, which I know you were only in Chicago for 4 months, but someday I don't want to burn time asking you how you knew all these little details about the L and the, But you know all of your films during that time, both horror and comedy, that they had a docudrama feel to them. They felt very real, and that was something that I don't think was happening in Hollywood very much at the time. Friedkin may have started it a few years before you did, but even Coming to America has a real quality of realism to it that it is completely gone now. No one does that
Coming
anymore.
Coming to America has a quality
compared
of
to today. If you compare it to the comedies of today. Absolutely.
It doesn't feel silly.
It doesn't feel silly. The characterizations are heightened, but what you were doing felt very grounded and had you're a very formalist filmmaker with your compositions, but the quality of light, the quality of the environments, the quality, it always felt like realism. And I think an important contribution to genre that is not often talked about.
Well, but I don't necessarily think that that's something that I was the innovator of. I mean, look at Buster Keaton or Laurel and Hardy or Harold Lloyd. Harold Lloyd is in the most. Have you ever seen that movie, Safety Love?
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't be more real yet more.
That's true.
Surreal.
Yeah,
that's true.
But was that something that was on your mind when you were making those films, or were you just?
I honestly can't tell you what was on my mind. I mean, sometimes in Werewolf, I really felt that to make this real, it had to be funny. Mm-hmm. Because the analogy I gave, I've never forget. Jim O'Rourke, who produced it, was my good friend. When I was trying to explain to him the tone of Werewolf. And there's something that Bob Hope, Mantan Moreland, Laurel and Hardy, the Stooges, certainly Abbott Costello, everyone does, which is that laughter over your shoulder. That's when you hear the terrible noise and you go, what is your response to it? And the example that I came up with in the early 70s to try to explain it to Jim was you two go to see some movie at Grauman's Chinese, whatever they call it now. So you go to see some horror picture. And you quite like it. It's scary and everything. It's great. Then you go out in that zoo of Hollywood Boulevard of all the freaks. And Elijah taps you and goes, look at that guy. Look at that guy. And you look, and about 10 feet from you is a man very tall, maybe 6'6", you know, really tall. And he's wearing a tuxedo and a black velour cape with red satin lining. He's got white makeup on, like he's painted white. And he's got a big greasy pompadour back like this. And you say, look at that guy. And he comes right up to you. And he says, good evening. I want to drink your blood. You're laughing. You would look at each other and say, yeah, okay, nice meeting you, you know. Now you're on your back on Hedy Lamarr's but you're on your back on the sidewalk, and he's ripping your throat out with his teeth. You're in pain. You're in shock. You don't have time to be scared. You just, you try to react, and you bleed to death, you're and dead. You're dead.
Yeah.
Not once, and you're standing there trying to get him off. You know, not once. In that entire sequence of events, would it even occur to you this is a creature of the night who is drinking human blood? It wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
And so,
this leads me to another question. Why horror? So I watched last night the Kaufman Invasion of the Body Snatchers for the millionth time, and was talking to my fiance about, you know, this is a movie about doom, but there's similar to American Werewolf. There's a point at which you start to reason. There's absolutely no way out for them. So what am I even watching at this point? Why am I so engaged watching these characters, their demise? But I am, and I come back to that movie over and over again. Clearly, it has some therapeutic value for me, as does American Werewolf. What is it? Why do we like to watch these people face
the end? Oh, there's so many. Okay, read my book. Because everyone in the interviews has different theories.
Yeah.
There's the standard theory, which is it's a way of experiencing death safely.
Practice.
Without experience. No, not practice. It's a way of actually going through, just like anything. It's a way of having that experience without literally having that experience. When you watch movies in which the Arctic explorers and the snot is frozen to their beards and their eyes, you know, it's like you can go, like Zhivago, you know, you can go through it with them, but you're nice and toasty and you're eating popcorn. You know, it's a way to experience something. And fear is the real question. What is so attractive about fear? And in a theater, in a fictional work, fear is something at least you can kind of control. Mm. And you know that when you finish the book or you finish the movie, you go outside and there, you know, you might have residual fear. I remember I saw The Exorcist. That was in the early 70s, I think. When was The Exorcist? What year?
I'd say 73.
Yeah, I think it was 73.
Well, it was at the National Theater of Westwood, which is torn down, long gone. Yeah. But it was a huge theater.
Yeah.
And it had been out like a week and was a sensation. And there were, you know, reports of people vomiting and screaming, running from
fainting,
the theater, fainting, you know. And I went to see it with Jim O'Rourke and George Folsey Jr. These two guys older than me were both altar boys and both lapsed Catholics.
Wow.
So I'm a secular Jew, so I don't believe in any of it. It's certainly not Jesus and certainly not the devil. I mean, Satan to me is one of the great alibis ever.
What a way to frame Satan.
Wow. Yeah. Well, he is. Because I didn't do it.
Yeah.
The devil made me do it.
It's the great justification for bad behavior.
It's the great justification for any bad behavior.
It's true.
And I don't believe in I believe in Trump, and I believe he's evil incarnate, but for very different reasons than being a supernatural fallen angel. Can I tell you a good Chris Lee story?
Yes, of course.
It's just, I really liked him. Michael Caine once said, nastily, bitchily, that Chris bores for England. And it was because Chris, when he got an audience, very much liked talking about Chris.
That's true.
And
I've been privy to that many times.
But I quite...
Gratefully.
I quite liked him, and he could be terribly funny.
Mm.
You must have heard Chris. He could go on.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that Chris had an extraordinary war. Did you know that? World War II.
Yes.
He was in, I don't know what it was called. It's before the OSS and before MI5. He was in Dirty Tricks. He basically, he spoke perfect Italian, German, Spanish, and French. By the way, he's in Italian, German, Spanish, and French movies speaking Italian, German, French. Anyway,
on press junkets, if it was a foreign press junket, he would change the language depending on who he was speaking to, because he could speak to almost every single person. Yeah.
But what's interesting is I don't know, that's all I know, I don't know anything about it. So I'd always say, Chris, tell me about the war. And he'd look at me and go, John, you know I'm not allowed to discuss it. So I'd say to his wife, get him to tell me about the war. And she'd say, John. And, you know, always, I'd always tease him. So one day we're at lunch. And, you know, he even when he was ill, he's so elegant, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I said, Chris, tell me about the war. And he thought about it. It was just us in this booth. And he leaned forward and he said, can you keep a secret? And, you know, I leaned forward and I said, yes. He said, so can I.
Oh, my God.
Amazing.
Chris had this amazing war that involved assassinations, was all behind enemy lines, involved assassinations, involved lots of weird stuff that he was forbidden to speak about. He had to sign the Official Secrets Act, and he could never discuss them. Mm-hmm. And every so often, if you're a big World War II person, you'll see him referenced, but it's always like, what? Wow. What? You know? And you speak to historians, especially British ones, they go, I think Christopher Lee was involved with that. But anyway, after the war, he spent 2 years hunting Nazis.
What?
And not capturing them, murdering them.
Christopher Lee?
And a bunch of British and American agents.
I have never heard this story.
Oh, yeah. Well, you never would. You must have spent a lot of time with him.
A fair amount of time, yeah. Over the course of 4 years.
We had this crazy pipe dream to make a film with him. Do you remember this?
I do.
Yeah,
he would have done it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we hit him a little late. But our concept was, we had a whole story, beat it out, and everything was that we wanted to create a sort of like alternate reality Christopher Lee, a giant star of genre cinema, living in London, who is ill, and he starts to realize that he's being kind of circled by the Grim Reaper. So he engages with the Grim Reaper. And makes the Grim Reaper a sort of a bet.
Now, if you're making a movie starring Christopher Lee as a faux Christopher Lee, who's playing the Grim Reaper?
We never got. We talked about like someone like Jude Law or some very young, beautiful kind of.
Man. Yeah, that's right.
But the concept was that he's playing himself. He's driving limos and you get that wish fulfillment of what it's like to be a big movie star. But he's grappling with the end, and in the end he wins the wager. He will be immortal. And we wanted to end the film by taking footage of him as a young man and digitally inserting it into a shot of this beautiful, you know, 32-year-old Christopher Lee kind of walking off into the sunset in London, who will live forever. We kept trying to get him on the phone, and Chris wasn't hard to reach unless he was ill.
It all came down to me. I was too anxious to approach him about it.
Was that what it was?
Just based on reverence for him.
Right. I remember this.
I was.
Oh, he was so anxious to work. He would do anything. He did that heavy metal record.
Oh, yeah.
He would do anything.
Yeah.
He did a lot of Italian opera music, too.
He was an opera singer.
Right. Yeah.
But he really was desperate to work.
He was, yeah.
Asshole.
I know.
My wife and I were very successful very young. And what that meant was, you know, for like my first 10 movies, I was the youngest person on the crew.
Right.
As the director. By the way, my last movie, I was the oldest person on the crew. But nonetheless, what that means is you're working intensely with people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. So now I'm in my 60s, which means they're either ancient or dead. So between that and AIDS, I know more dead people. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And that's true of everyone, by the way,
sure.
Of your parents. And
yeah.
It's just, But that is weird.
I remember sitting with Jerry Lewis once where he opened up his address book and leafed through it with me and showed me all the crossouts.
Did you see Mr. Warmth, the film I made about Don Rickles?
Yeah, I love Mr. Warmth.
There's a moment of Mr. Warmth when Don goes in. It's his bathroom, actually, but he goes in, and there are all of these photographs signed to him by Frank Sinatra, Clark Gable, Burt Lancaster, you know, every Jackie Gleason. I mean, all the great Milton Berle, everybody, Bob Hope, you name it. And Don looks at them and goes, dead, dead. Dead. Not looking good. Dead. Cancer. Dead. You know, like, yeah, and it's like, it's so weird.
Yeah. What was the last time you talked to him?
I talked to him about 3 weeks before he passed.
And he was in the hospital at that time?
No, he was home.
Oh,
dying.
Oh, God. What was that conversation like?
Well, it was, you know, not much. It was, hi, Don.
Yeah.
Stop hounding me, he said.
Did you acknowledge in the conversation what was happening? Was he someone that could talk about those things?
He talked about it, but not, no, he was very, very, very ill.
Yeah.
But the year before, how old was he? He was 89 or whatever he was.
I think he was 91.
91, but the year before, there was an election year. And I remember we were talking, and somebody asked him who he's voting for. And he said, voting? I'm 90. What the fuck? I don't care. I'm out of here. You know? By the way, my 96-year-old mother just voted. So that was
Wow. Oh, that's incredible.
Wow. Where is she?
In the Jewish home in the Valley.
Okay.
And
which one?
There's only one Jewish home.
Oh, there's
home.
Only
there's
one.
Two campuses.
The Jewish home. Okay, got
the Jewish home. Yeah. Who opened by Mary Pickford, which is bizarre.
Oh, incredible. Whoa.
She was not Jewish. Huh. But it's an older place, although the buildings are much newer. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I was talking, I wrote that monster book,
yeah.
You know, my book, and I was interviewing all these people, and David Cronenberg, who's one of the smartest people I know. What Cronenberg said about zombies that I thought was particularly smart was he said that zombies represent our future in that everybody grows old. Mm. And as you grow old, you become, I mean, if you go to many convalescent homes or many real homes for the aged, who are those people in those robes shuffling around or sitting in wheelchairs in the hall or just rotting? Their limbs are falling off. They, you know, they have to be fed. They have to, and he thinks it's a real obvious metaphor for age and illness.
Wow.
And it's fascinating because you can come up with millions of reasons. I mean, if you ask me 15 years ago, if a TV show like Walking Dead would be an international success with that level of gore and violence, I would have said, I don't think so. Wrong. This is my life's collection here, but I have to tell you, the stuff in here, it's like me, it's high-low. It ranges from extremely valuable to complete junk.
Okay.
Yeah. And these are mostly 99% lead figures, but I've been collecting them my whole life. So here's the thing. These are all gorillas and King Kong.
Yeah.
Okay. These are all Wolfmen.
Uh-huh.
These are all characters from my movies, toys that people make.
Yep.
I've never seen this before.
The Bluesmobile, yeah. They sold those.
What year?
I don't know. You could probably still buy it.
Yeah.
Go on eBay.
Yeah.
It's really good. I mean, it's like serious heavy duty. And look how I love how they dirtied it.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Is it, what, may I hold it? What?
Yeah, sure. It's a toy.
Oh, it's heavy.
Look on
it's
the bottom. Great. Does it say who made it? I don't know. Don't, you know what?
Don't, okay.
No,
you said look on the bottom.
You know, no, I was right. But you know what I was going to say? These fucking things always pop out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's, anyway. It's just like the car in the movie.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a toy.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
These are all movie-related figures. And this, oh, wait, up here. This is France. This is the United States. Oh. And this whole long thing here is medieval, and this is evil.
Wow.
Wow. So who's here in evil? Is that Trump?
Of course it's Trump.
It sure is.
There's a little sad little George Bush.
Like Sauron. Amazing.
All right, John, we're almost done.
I'm sorry.
No, it's great. I have two final questions for you. One is we're just on the topic of fear and how films allow you to face your fears. What are you afraid of? What scares you now at this point in your life?
That always scared me. People.
Yeah.
People scare me. Deborah, my wife, can see any movie with a monster. Any ghost movie, any creature movie, any monster movie, anything with a monster. But movies like, any movies with a movie. You know what I think is genuinely a great movie?
What?
Mary Harron, I think. American Psycho.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Genuinely a great movie. She could never see that.
I don't mean in movies. I mean in life.
Same thing.
People. Yeah.
People really terrify me. Someone who can vote for Trump, it terrifies me. Mm-hmm. It really frightens me. Mm-hmm. Are you that? You're either that racist or that wealthy or that white or that fearful or that just stupid?
Ignorant.
What are you? Just stupid? Or are you just, you don't give a fuck about your grandchildren?
Yeah.
They're denying global warming, the planet. You know, I mean, what people don't understand is Earth's going to be fine. I mean, we'll use it up, and then everyone will die.
Earth will shake us off like a case of fleas.
That's true. Yeah. Earth will recover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But man will be gone. Yeah. And the future, you know, 60% of animals are extinct within the last 15 years.
Oh, man.
Is that a true statistic?
Oh, no. The statistic, when you go, you know, it's like you want to buy beachfront property now, I wouldn't advise it. You know, it's like this thing where it's just, I want to reopen coal mines. Mm. Yeah. I want to pollute and I want to, by the way, coal mining, the most dangerous profession in the world.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah.
I want to give these men the right to, I want them to have the right to get black lung, to die in explosions and lose limbs and be underpaid. I want them to have the right to dig coal out, which any sane person knows you can't use. Mm. I worked in London quite a bit. And the first time I spent a long time in London was 1975. I was one of the many writers of The Spy Who Loved Me. 1975 the last year. I got great stories from that. But 1975 is the last year of coal burning. Well, there were big London fogs constantly. Mm. They stopped burning coal. Guess what?
Fog stopped.
No more fog. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's so obvious.
Yep.
When
when we talked on the phone the other day, I asked you, is this
that scares me.
Is this worse than 68? And you said,
far worse.
You said yes.
Far worse, because most of the chaos, there was a real sense of, you know what people forget, is the civil rights movement was pretty fucking successful. And I come to believe that when we got a black president, there was an African-American president, I think there's a segment of the population whose heads blew up.
Same.
Just deeply racist, white, stupid. I mean, just white supremacist. Plus, the reality is those guys are going to be white men.
We're on the way out.
Are going to be in the minority very soon.
I think they're
crazy scared.
Yeah.
And I think so, too.
We've had this exact
conversation. I think they're just being nuts.
So what is this, given this divide in our country, what does this do to movies, which are supposed to be unifying, which are...
No, movies are always reflective, and they always... It's very much like the press. The media is always reactionary because the media reacts and reports. And so this canard of the liberal press is ridiculous. I mean, it's never been true. It never will be true. There might be individuals... personally who are liberal, but their job is to sell advertising.
Right, of course.
So, you know, and movies, you get all kinds of interesting movies. And they do reflect in many ways what's going on. They don't predict it, you know.
When a guy like Trump can divide us to the extent that he has, how does a single movie reflect both of those experiences at the same time?
I don't know. I mean, that it depends on the movie. You can, like, the biggest hit now, The Star Is Born, basically has a choice, which is this doesn't take place in a definable time.
Mm.
When is this? I don't know exactly. You know?
Right.
And it's about these two individuals and has nothing to do with anything else. Mm-hmm. You know, and you really can't look at that movie and say, well, this reflects this. No, it doesn't. Yeah. It's a remake of
a love
story.
That's my point, is that I wonder what conversations are happening, like in Marvel, where they're going, is there anything in here that could be viewed as political? Let's get it out.
It's all, well, first of all, as Godard said, everything's political.
Of course. Yeah.
So when you make a movie, the way you dress in the morning is political. Whatever you do is political. Sure. So when you make a movie, there are very strong politics in that movie, whether you know it or not. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, I think it's on the Criterion version of Videodrome. But Universal, in its wisdom, made really the first infomercial kind of thing. It was Mick Garris, who was working in publicity at the time. He was the host. And I had made American Werewolf. So it was 1981 that came out. This is 1982. So my movie's out and gone. But John was finishing up the thing, and David had made Videodrome. These are two Universal pictures that are going to come out. So Mick had this round table, this, you know, I don't know, Titans of Terror or some stupid thing. But what was interesting is it's interesting because we get very political. We start talking about Reagan and censorship and stuff. But what's fascinating about it is there's me and John and David. First, we're so fucking young, it's shocking.
This is on the Criterion edition.
Yeah, it's on the Criterion video drum.
Need to see this. Okay.
It's Mick Garris. Yep. But it's, we're all, how old was I? I was 31, I think. And we were all very young, and we all had dark hair. We were all thin. And what's interesting about it, there was a moment that isn't really there because Mick took it out. But it was a very interesting moment, and which is you really have to think about what you're putting in a movie. You have to justify it, to at least to yourself. And Mick brought up the idea. This is 1982. He brings up the idea of, it's now called The Final Girl, but he brings up this thing about, he says, why is it in movies that, and this was the slasher boom, you know, why is it in movies that when women are promiscuous or show their breast, they're murdered, while the virginal ones live? And all of us went, well, you know, like struggling, you know, like you know, that's just, we're a Puritan country, I don't know, you know. And John says, well, I don't think that's true. And Mick goes, Halloween. And John went, where in Halloween? And there was this moment on his face where he realized that that's Halloween.
That Laurie Strode was a virgin. And
she's a virgin. She, and the others who show their breasts or have sex are
killed. So John Carpenter's psyche created this whole paradigm.
Not at all. No, that was a, trope that was in everything.
Okay.
But my point is that John realized it was in his movie.
Right.
And it's so opposite John Carpenter, who's always been a big feminist, you know. And it was so interesting to see him, like it dawned, this look of, oh, my God. And David, God bless him, immediately went, well, in Toronto, I know that at my high school, the women who slept with men were horribly killed. And I immediately said, yes, also at at my high school, the girls who showed their breasts were horribly killed.
Oh, that's a brilliant
but
save.
That was cut out, you know. Oh. But this, I'll never forget that moment of John going, oh, my God. Speaking of which, did you hear about those murders in Encino?
What?
No.
In the last 4 days?
No.
Four women, knifed. They found them in the bathtubs. They were all in their bathtubs filled with milk and sliced bananas. They think it was the work of a serial killer.
You are kidding me.
Oh!
Wow, I totally fell for that.
That was good. That was good.
Milk and sliced bananas. That's good.
All right, I'm gonna.
You know what I love the most is that you were even more horrified.
I was.
What kind of sick fuck would put milk and sliced bananas?
Bananas.
You were a maniac, for God's sake.
I am very gullible by nature.
I am too.
Here, this is neat. Come here.
Okay.
Okay. Lift up that rock.
Oh, God.
That's a meteorite.
What?
Yeah, so it's this. That came from outer space.
Wow.
Hurtling through the universe.
Really? That is incredible.
I can't believe how heavy it is.
This is signed by Chaplin. This is actually signed to me by Boris Karloff, who I saw when I was a little boy at the Huntington Hartford, which is now called the Ricardo Montalban Theater.
Yes.
So it used to be the Henry Fonda Theater.
Right.
Yeah. It was the Huntington Hartford Theater, and I saw him in Peter Pan. He was Captain Hook.
Wow.
And I met him after.
Oh, wow. But I like your hula girls.
That's signed to me by Michael, but that's me and Mike and Mickey.
Wow.
Wow.
At Disney World. Wow. And then here, so this is Ray Harryhausen, and this is Groucho, signed that to me, and they didn't sign it to me, but that's Laurel and Hardy. Mm. That's Christopher Lee, but because that's from Schlock, that's me and Ford.
Oh, man.
And he's on the cover of that. He's
just amazing.
Who else I got? I got interesting people. The Beatles, they all signed it.
Oh, my God.
When they were the Beatles, but Paul signed that to me. That's Ward Kimball. That's Gene Kelly. That's Harryhausen again. Who else? Joe Dante told me 6 or 7, 8 years ago, he said, "You want to get depressed?" And I said, "No." He said, "Look yourself up on eBay."
Oh, God.
And you go to eBay and you type in my name, and it's like, holy shit, there's movie posters and scripts and tons of autographed pictures. And, you know, what Joe said by depressed, he's right. Because, first of all, 25% of them, maybe a fourth of them, are fakes.
Right.
You know, but they're selling Animal House scripts signed by the cast that's a complete fraud. They've been selling them for years. You know? But anyway, but you see pictures that you signed. I signed, you know, pictures, but they're weird because they're pictures from 40 years ago all the way up, you know, all these old studio publicity pictures and shit. And what's so weird is like, oh, look, I'm young and thin. Oh, look, I'm old and fat. You know, it's like, oh, look, my hair's black. But what's depressing are the prices. Because, you know, here's a signed picture from John Lennon selling it for $300. And you think, wow, $300. Oh, here's one for $800. Here's one for $4. You know, here's one for $8.
Well, we better break it down.
Yeah, get out.
We gotta get out of here in 10 minutes. So let's give our guys a chance to break
it down. And now you know why I say no to podcasts, because they just go this way. Yes, okay. Turn us off. Turn off everything.
Yeah, no, just.
We're done.
What's the name of your podcast?
We think it's going to be called Visitations, but we haven't cleared it yet.
That sounds like an alien, you know, like a sci-fi show.
That was kind of the idea.
That is so good, yeah.
Oh, look at that. He actually reads the contract.
Yeah, because it's terrifying what people sign. But, you know, the truth is, these mean nothing. Did you know that? That I signed this, you think, oh, we got a release.
Yeah.
I can still sue you.
Yeah.
It's a good location as well.
You should have filled that out, God damn it.
People don't like that.
Who doesn't like that? It's a location release.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I warned them you were tough. John, thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you so much.
Goodbye. All right, get up.
All right.
Thanks, John.
See you, John.
Thank you.
Next up, listen in on our conversation with The Girl Walks Home Alone at Night and Bad Batch director, Anna Lily Amirpour.
If you dare.
Ooh.
This has been Visitations. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so that you never miss an episode. Visitations is a Shudder original podcast. Download the app or visit Shudder.com to start your free 7-day trial.
Visitations was created by Spectrevision, hosted by Daniel Noah and myself, Elijah Wood. Executive produced by Daniel Noah, Josh C. Waller, Lisa Whalen, and me. Produced by Elisa Yeris. This episode's on-set producer was also Elisa Yeris. Edited and mixed by Graham Resnick. Post-supervisor, Lauren Magura. Production sound provided by Brian Curley. Our PA is Guillermo Patricios. Our stills photographer was Lisa Consol. Original artwork by Jay Shaw. For Shudder, Owen Shiflett and Nicholas Lazo. And our music was composed by Bad Bad Not Good.